Donald on the Kitchen talks about food. Donald on the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on Community Radio. Welcome to the Donald on the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We gather here at our kitchen table once a week to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we are here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa. The center of Ames, the center of it all. Yes, it is. Yes, it is. So I know spring is sort of like on the horizon, but March came in like a lamb, and it's going out like a lion. It just is kind of cold today, but Don and I got some onions in the ground already.
Are they peeking up?
Well, yeah, see, I plant onion plants, and although they may not like to be snowed on, the important part of the onion is way below the ground, and it's snuggled in, and I went out there and looked yesterday after the first snow had melted, and they will be just fine. I'll be talking about onions a little later in this program.
Okay, so this is a sign of hope.
Oh, it...
Okay.
Forever the optimist, I am a gardener. Yes, I am. So we look forward to spring. There's spring planting. The food cycle does keep going, Donna. Today on the Donald on the Kitchen, we're going to consider where our food comes from. It comes from the soil, yes. It comes from farmers, yes. But for most of us, there are many hands that pick, sort, slaughter, process, and pack what we eat before it ever gets to the grocery store. Immigration is seen as a hot-button issue in national politics, but we may just need all those workers to help keep food on our plates.
Yeah, I think today we're going to call this a little bit of fact-checking about these immigrant scares that they're coming to take our jobs. Well, hello, wait a minute. We got jobs aplenty that no one wants to take because we're not letting those people in to help us. So with us today, we have Professor Jan Flora. He's Professor Emeritus at Iowa State University in the College of Agriculture. He was an extension community sociologist. He is a rural sociologist, and he knows all about these people that we need here in Iowa. So, Jan, welcome to the show, and help us with a little fact-checking on some of this, the horror stories of immigrants here that we keep seeing in the tabloid, practically, news. So,
welcome to our table. That's good.
I'm happy to be here.
Good. You recently wrote an op-ed piece for the paper, and it says, immigrants serve the common good, including in Iowa. Those are the facts. So tell us what some of these facts about immigrants are.
Yeah, some of the misconceptions that we're reading about daily.
Well, I'm going to talk mainly about economic contributions, but there are lots of other things that are important about having immigrants among us, particularly given the fact that about 98% of us, I guess, are immigrants or children of immigrants somewhere down the line. And so what's happening in Iowa today is that we have a severe labor shortage. And that's not just true of Iowa, but it seems to be worse than in our surrounding states. And so it's kind of interesting that during the Trump administration, there was a crackdown on immigrants coming in, and particularly we normally receive about 1 million refugees per year. And I think that Trump reduced that to about 15% of that. That is a
drastic
150,000, I think, in his last full year as president, and that had a major implication then for labor availability throughout the country. And in Iowa in particular, we have a serious problem of lack of population growth. And if it hadn't been for the immigrants, we would actually have shown a decline in Iowa's population over the past several years.
What is that due to?
Go ahead. It's due to a multiplicity of factors, but one of the things that is particularly notable is that Iowa trains a lot of folks at the university level, and most of them go other places to get jobs because the pay level in Iowa isn't that great. We have a rather small share of the population of the workers that are members of labor unions, and we continue to adhere to the $7.25 an hour minimum wage that only that the majority of states have already raised. And so we have a need for workers. And I think that was particularly notable during the time of the pandemic, because an awful lot of the workers who were defined as frontline workers and whom we had to have working, which meant that they were at a greater risk of getting COVID, a great percentage of them were Latinos or other immigrants. So they played a really important role, and they made some major sacrifices. We had very high rates of COVID and deaths from COVID among Latinos in particular, and those who worked, especially those who worked in meatpacking plants during COVID. But the larger picture was that we simply weren't receiving as many immigrants as we had been in beginning in the 1990s and going into the current century.
Well, remember those immigration rates that we had in Postville and someplace else? I don't know, when was it? 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago? Did that put a dent in making immigrants want to come to Iowa?
Yeah, I think it did. The raid in Postville was in 2008, and there was there were raids in Marshalltown in 2006. And I think a couple of other raids around that time. So that had a significant impact, particularly on the meatpacking industry, because they decided that they were going to hire people who had papers, and that meant that a lot of the immigrants who didn't have papers found it more difficult to find jobs. And a little bit later, I want to talk about farm workers, particularly in Sioux County, where we did a study. And a very high proportion of the farm workers are undocumented because the farmers don't require clear paperwork for them to actually work legally.
Are they supposed to require paperwork, or they do, or is it they don't have to have paperwork?
Well, if you go back to the 1986 law, which was called IRCA, it does place it gives fines to, allows for fines to employers who hire undocumented workers knowingly. So that knowingly part is a slippery slope. So it really depends on what kind of a firm you are, and the larger firms tend to require documentation. But even then, people can obtain false documents, and generally those companies will not pursue trying to figure out whether the documents that people have are really their own documents. It's interesting because the business community has pushed back pretty hard against having requirements that the employers supervise documentation. And in the present legislative session, there was a bill on providing E-Verify, which is a system that's organized by the federal government, so that every employer would have to use E-Verify to determine whether or not somebody was here legally or not. The problem is that that system is not, it has both false positives and false negatives. And so lots of people get caught in those errors. And the employers just don't want to be in the business of being an immigration service. So it's interesting that that bill did not make it through the funnel. And so it's dead. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason that it didn't make it was that the business community probably put some pressure on some of the members of the legislature to make sure that it didn't pass. On the other hand, we have a bill which did pass, which, to the best of my knowledge, hasn't been signed by the governor yet. And I would encourage people to ask her not to sign it. And that bill is modeled on the Texas SB 4 bill, which allows, in Texas, it allows the state government and local governments to engage in racial profiling in order to determine whether someone has legal papers or not, and then they are deported. In Iowa, the proposal, the bill that hasn't yet been signed by the governor is rather similar, and it talks about reentry of people who once were not allowed to enter the country. And so Iowa, which is not a border state, to the best of my knowledge, unless geography has shifted a great deal, it now is likely to have a law where our state or local governments, we're not sure which, will have to foot the bill of deporting people. So the idea is that we'll have racial profiling, they don't call it that, of course, in order to find out whether someone has papers or not. Mm-hmm. And if they don't, then they are will be subjected to a prison sentence, most likely. And once they serve that prison sentence, then they will be deported, not to their home country that they originally came from, but to the country that they were last in before they arrived in the U.S., which most of the time means Mexico. You can imagine that Mexico is not terribly happy about that.
Yeah, hasn't there been some diplomatic pressure from Mexico against this sort of thing?
Yes, there has. They just haven't been terribly effective. If the U.S. governments, including state as well as the national government, say this is the way it's going to be, why Mexico, at least until now, has buckled under. But you can imagine how difficult it is for Mexico to, or would be, and was during the Trump administration, to either receive people who are deported from the U.S., or there was a program for remaining in Mexico that Trump had. And what's particularly interesting, we have what I call immigration silliness on the part of both parties on the national level. So now we have Biden pushing for a bill that the Republicans refused to pass because they thought, Trump thought that it would be better for his reelection if the border was sort of festering through the election. And so mm-hmm. Biden has picked up on that, and he now wants to repass that bill. I don't think the Republicans will go along because they see this as a real battering ram in terms of their opportunity to win at the ballot box in November. And it appears that the same thing is true at the state level. The fact that we have passed a bill, not yet signed by the governor, that would have state judges become immigration judges, even though they're not trained to deal with that, that would further burden our prison system. So we would either pay more for our prisons because we'd have more people in them, or we'd have even greater labor shortages there.
And, this is not a win-win. And this is a lose-lose, right?
Yeah. And then we'd also have all of the expenses of litigation, and we seem to have an attorney general who likes to, at the drop of a hat, file litigation against the Biden administration. So we have the same, something going on at the state level. And I might say that Iowa is only the second state to have passed by the legislature one of these laws that essentially allows the state to take over the role that is allocated to the federal government, both national court precedents and Iowa Supreme Court precedents say that is not a state function, and that indeed we should follow the U.S. Constitution and allow it to be a federal function as it has been for well over 250 years.
Well, maybe when Texas secedes from the Union, Iowa will go with them, you know? We could just have a little tunnel between Iowa and Texas or something like that.
A strange thing, and at the head of all of this, or I should say at the bottom of all of this, the immigrants are demonized and singled out for punishment. And we find out that really, truly, farm workers, food workers, we depend on these people. I have a little bit of a little quote here to share from Art Cullen. If you haven't heard, Storm Lake is part of Iowa. It's a small town, kind of up in the upper left-hand corner of the state. And it was a small town, and it wasn't doing too well until they started getting immigrants who were willing to deal with all the pork production that happens to happen up there in Buena Vista County. Art Cullen wrote an article in response to a request from Kate Couric, CBS news person.
Yeah, one of those national.
Yeah, she talked to Art Cullen a couple years ago, and she recently asked him, "Well, how are things going in Storm Lake?"
And with all those immigrants,
yeah. And Art sort of talked about a lot of things, but he reminded her that people willing to work, the immigrants in their community, actually has kept their town together. He also reminded us that the peak of the COVID infestation that we had, the COVID scare, in 2020, Storm Lake was the hottest spot in the U.S. For COVID infections, trading places with other meatpacking towns, Waterloo and Storm Lake, actually the Tyson plant shut down for days. But the immigrants, the people that worked there, kept on working when they could. Throughout the worst of the COVID scare, they worked without all the right protection, without vaccines. Some died, and they still don't know how many. Anything to keep pork and deli turkey moving to your grocery store. That's kind of an update from Storm Lake, and they're still there. Because of that, Storm Lake has schools that are full, Main Street businesses that are opening and thriving. We remember that these are people that help our bottom line. Yes, they do. I want to take a little break here, and we'll come back to talk a lot more with Dr. Jen Flora about immigrants, why we need immigrants. This is KHOI, Community Radio, and you're listening to the Donna Lena Kitchen Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa. This is the Donna Lena Kitchen. We're talking to Jan Flohr.
Yeah, so Jan had his article recently in both the Ames Tribune and the Des Moines Register about all the good things that immigrants do bring. Jan, you want to talk about the Social Security benefits that are coming into our system?
I'd heard a lot of figures thrown around about how large an amount of contributions that folks who are undocumented make both to the Social Security system and also to the Medicare trust fund.
Right, because if they're working, money has to be taken out of their paycheck and paid into Social Security and Medicare, just like it does for everyone else.
Yep, exactly. And basically, since there's no pathway to citizenship or to getting a green card even, if you are undocumented, many people remain in this country for a long time being undocumented and have no right then to the Social Security that they paid into, and generally find it difficult to even get Medicare insurance when they retire. So I did some calculations and had to do some interpolation and so on. And if you look at the amount that undocumented people or unauthorized, they is sort of the more official term, people pay into these two programs together, it turns out that it's somewhere between $275 and $300 billion since 1990. So basically what's happened is that the undocumented folks have given those of us who receive Social Security and Medicare benefits an added lease on life, you might say. It has extended the time at which it's estimated that the two programs would essentially begin running, would run out of money. And so we need to thank immigrants whenever we meet them and say, we really appreciate your contributing to our welfare after we retire.
You know, that's an interesting, because if you kind of listen to the normal chatter that's going on in the zeitgeist that's really anti-immigrant, and you think they're all going to come here, they're all going to get on welfare, they're all going to suck us dry, take away our jobs, when in fact-checking, they're actually contributing through taxes and paying Social Security, things that they will never recoup for themselves. So they are contributing not only their employment, you know, doing jobs that we haven't been able to fill with other workers. So they're really bringing us a lot. And I have seen small pockets of, like, for example, I saw an article, and this is very Iowa specific, but a group of farmers that are generally Republican in the up in Palo Alto County and around there, they are begging to have more farm workers, more immigrants, because they don't have enough workers for their jobs. So I don't know what our state is, you know, who we're pandering to, but we need these immigrants. And Jan has worked for a long time with a lot of immigrants all over the state. And so these statistics that you have come up with saying just how much they do actually, in fact, contribute to the economy is rather brilliant. Thank you so much.
And Jen, I want to be clear. Okay, so because they're getting a paycheck, they're paying into my Social Security and all of this stuff, but they are ineligible for a lot of government services. That seems
right. They don't get
unfair.
It back.
Yeah, that seems rather unfair.
They don't get SNAP. They don't get Obamacare. They're not eligible for TANF, which is the old welfare program redone. CHIP, the child insurance program, or SSI, which is for disabled people. They do receive WIC, so children are sometimes treated a little bit different than their parents, and we've been working with the local organization in assisting a family from Venezuela that is that came last year, and it's possible for the children to get some of these programs that are focused on children, the paperwork is immense, and in that sense, we're also benefiting from the presence of undocumented workers.
Well, you say in your op-ed that workers are scarce in nursing homes, child care centers, hospitals, and schools. Iowa immigrants work in meatpacking. 45% are immigrants. Animal production, 16%, and nursing facilities, 12%. And as packaging machine operators, 53%. What's a packaging machine operator?
It as I understand it, it simply means you're packaging something. You're putting something, you're essentially working on the line.
Some kind of factory.
Doing repetitive.
Right. Maids and housekeepers are 26%, and construction laborers are 18%, and janitors are 15%. Sounds like we need these people.
Well, yeah. If the immigrants weren't doing this, who would do it? I don't know. I don't know. I don't want to work in a meatpacking plant. Thank you. It's hard. It seems like very necessary work.
Well, the Japanese have, they've tried using robots to serve elderly and disabled people. I'm not sure that speaking is one of those people. I would be very happy being served by a robot.
I don't think it sounds awkward, doesn't it?
With AI and everything, maybe they can perform almost like humans. I don't know.
Oh my goodness.
Well, you also mentioned in your op-ed about Kim Reynolds sending the Iowa National Guard down to Texas, and that she spent $300,000 in state funds, and that was money that was supposed to be used in the state. How does she get away with that? Sounds to me like a misappropriation of funds.
Yeah, it certainly is. If we think about all of the needs that we have, the need for child care and mental health, etc. So, that's not a good thing. But she did figure out how to use the federal government's money, which she, of course, is opposed to its appropriation, but using the American Rescue Plan Act funds to fund the National Guard people who went last year to Texas. So we have a love affair with Texas, and I'm not sure it's the kind that we should have.
Well, we'll see. You had another, I want to read this quote. This is somebody named Larry Zimpelman. He's the ex-CEO of Principal Financial Group. recently explained that when his company expanded decades ago, it drew from young people from mid-sized rural cities like Osceola and Grinnell, but because of Iowa's slow population growth and the emptying out of smaller rural communities, that source of employees has dried up. He lamented that for two decades, executives have been telling state officials that Iowa needs to recruit more immigrants, to no avail. So how are we going to turn this ship around before we really run into more trouble here in Iowa?
Well, I guess it seems to me that we need to build coalitions of organizations, both private and public, that would that could work toward both reform at the state level as well as at the national level. So I really think we need a coalition of local business people, local governments, civic leaders, to really begin pushing for comprehensive immigration reform, so that we don't have this permanent second-class group of folks among us. And whereas we gain some advantages through Social Security, et cetera, it's really not the best way to move forward in terms of economic and community development, because if the workers who are undocumented were documented, they would contribute even more to the economy than they do now. So I think that's an important thing to think about.
Well, is it your hope, instead of, you know, unfortunately we've made these into kind of very negative, just racist issues, but really there are serious economic consequences, and is it your hope, by pointing out these statistics, that some of the, you know, besides social justice, there are also people who really pay attention to the economics of the whole thing. And so when the economics are favoring more immigration, do you hope that will swing the public sentiment towards a more positive? I mean, after all, we're the state that, you know, 20 or some years ago imported all of the immigrants from Southeast Asia and took care of them. And it was an Iowa thing. And now we're like the bottom of the pile with this sort of thing.
Yeah, it seems that our social conscience is kind of getting bowled over by a lot of other things. We've learned to fear people, fear what happens. And I don't know, the idea of economic development fixing things, that might be a result of it. But I think we have a lot of soul searching and humanity to work on first.
Well, I'm going to be cynical, but we don't seem to be soul searching much these days. But if it's a pocketbook issue, maybe we'll make some headway.
That's it. And your article, Jan, has a lot to do with pocketbook issues. I mean, farmers, the idea of farmers needing help is really important. And
that's an age-old thing, the hired hand, the farm helpers. We need that to grow all these corn and soybeans.
And children, young people, are not sticking around on the farm, at least as far as I know. So, and things need to be done. I know, Jet, there are things like robot milkers for cows, but I don't think robots can do everything on the farm. This has to do with our food system.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for pointing out all of the economic issues involved here and having a more rational approach to this conversation. We hope it does some good at the state level. We seem to be going a little bit crazy here in Iowa.
Well, I think there's one other thing that I'd like to point out, and that is that I think we need to distinguish our leaders, such as they are, from people in general. And I think in Iowa, there's still the same kind of feeling toward immigrants that we found when Governor Ray was governor.
I hope so.
We have a larger political problem that we have to deal with too. And I think Iowans will come out on the right side if they're able to express themselves politically in an effective way.
And if they're given correct information also, you know, instead of just, I mean, like these facts and figures about how immigrants are actually adding to our economy, we need to know this and be respectful of it.
Right, right.
Yeah. So thank you for getting these op-eds into our newspapers and calling attention to these issues in ways that, instead of just being emotional issues, these are very rational things, and moral as well. So good job. Thank you, Jan.
Thank you, Jan. We've been talking to Jan Flohr, Professor Emeritus at Iowa State University in the College of Agriculture, where he worked as a Extension Community Sociologist. He's been talking about information that he put in the paper recently in an editorial called Immigrants Serve the Common Good, Including in Iowa. Those are the facts. We've enjoyed talking with you today. Thank you, Jan.
Yeah, you're welcome.
You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more about the Donna Lana Kitchen at khoyfm.org. We have archives there. And find out more about all the other stuff that goes on here at the KHOI radio station. And we have a podcast, too.
We do. So our show, which is live, if you can't tell today, so it's live on Tuesdays at noon, repeated on the air at 7 o'clock on Tuesday. Then by Thursday, the same content goes into a podcast, which can be accessed anywhere that you listen to podcasts. Just type in Donna Lana, that's one word, D-O-N-N-A-L-O-N-N-A, kitchen, and you will find us there.
Good. Let's listen to another bit of music here by the Barn Owl Band. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. I said earlier I was going to talk about onions. Yes, I did put some onions in the ground, and yes, it did snow on them. Well, good for them. We've been needing the moisture, and I trust my little onions to be relatively
resilient.
Relatively. They are. They are relatively resilient. I plant onions from onion plants. You can get onion plants, what looks like little scallions about the size of your finger. And I plant those to get a boost on the season, because the idea of onions is you want them to grow, and have a good life all spring. And then they start bulbing up. And the more green is that's on the top of the onion, the more chance you have of having a good bulb on the bottom. And starting onions early is good. That's why I buy these starts, and they are started by people. Actually, I buy them from a company in Texas. They start early. They have spring a lot earlier than we do, and that is important. They plant by seeds and send me plants.
Wait, so when do you put them in the ground?
Now.
Oh.
End of March-ish.
Okay.
End of March-ish. But they they really, I'm sure they goose them on with all kinds of fertilizer and heaven knows what. But you can plant from seed. Yes, you can. And one thing you want to remember, you don't want to be weeding onions a whole lot. So try to make the place you put your onions semi-weed free and mulch them if you can, because onions look a whole lot like grass when they're growing up. But I want to read a little bit here from a book that I refer to most every spring, because I can't remember all this stuff. The book is called The New Seed Starter's Handbook by Nancy Bubel, and she has a little bit to say about onions. Why is it necessary to get such an early start with onions from seed? Because the onion's ability to form a bulb is influenced by the length of the day. It's the short, dark period that makes the onions shape up. Onions suitable for the northern states are called long-day onions. I plant long-day onions. They start to form bulbs when the days grow long and the nights grow short. Think summer solstice. If you've gotten a head start with your seedlings, or if I buy seedlings, your onion plants will be well developed by bulbing time and therefore vigorous enough to produce a good size bulb. When the day length becomes right, a spindly young onion plant will bulb up on cue. But if it's a spindly plant, but the bulb will be spindly. If it has a nice green top, you'll get a nice bulb on the bottom. And I don't know how onions know how to do this, but they know how to put their growth into the top early in the season. And then when the day length becomes right, as in midsummer, well, June is a good time. The light is changing. Then the bulbs will be growing underground. Actually, at that time, as the bulb grows underground, the top of the plant starts to kind of give up and put all of its energy into the plants. So that's what I'm doing for
onions. I want to ask you about something you had introduced several of us to, the walking onions. How do those work?
Well, onions are the allium family. It is the onions. And
garlic.
And garlic.
Yeah.
Some garlic and some onions make little flowers. Well, they all make flowers on top if you let them go to flowers. But some of those flowers make seeds and actually little onion bulbs on the top of the plant. And those drop and self-seed and you have some next year. I can't say I've ever had a big onion come out of that, but it works. It works. They will seed themselves.
So what we've done, and I don't have any, but Lana started us on this, and so you end up with really almost like scallion-like tops.
Yeah.
So they're starting to come up now.
Yeah, yeah.
And so if you have them in your garden, you can actually go out now and be picking some fresh green onions to chop into your dinner.
Yeah. There's different varieties. They do come at different times, but the main bulbing onion works on this grow in the spring, bulb up in the summer time. Onions are magic things, and how they know all these things, I do not know, but I'm glad they do.
You know, the other thing, have you had garlic chives up yet?
Yes, I even ate some garlic chives last week.
Okay, I'm going to go out and check.
Unusually warm spring. I mean, we've got some daffodils coming in early, but look for those garlic chives. Same family.
They're quite edible. They're weeds, okay? But I have a lot of them in the backyard, and I haven't even looked yet. So I thought, one of the things I like to do this time of year is just boil up some pasta. Put a little salt and pepper and butter, and then lots of the garlic scapes. You know, they're free in the backyard. You just want to do them where they're clean, right?
That's one of the good tastes of spring.
It is.
I want to share a poem about onions. Yes, there are poems about onions. And I think I've read this poem a long time ago on the Donnell in the Kitchen. But it's spring. It's onion planting season. And this is by Roy Blount Jr. He's a He writes about funny things, but he also writes about food. And this is his Song to Onions. They improve everything. Pork chops to soup. And not only that, but each onion's a group. Peel back the skin, delve into the tissue, and see how an onion has been blessed with issue. Every layer produces an onion. Huh? It does. Every layer produces an ovum. You'd think you've got three when you've actually got four of them. Onions on onions on onions they run. Each but the smallest one is some onion's mother. As an onion comprises a half dozen other. In sum, then, an onion, you could say, is less than the sum of its part, but then I like to think that things are more than they profess in food and in the arts. By the way, a bologna sandwich would be good right now with onions. It would be right good. And so would sliced onions chewed with cheese, or onions chopped and sprinkled over black-eyed peas. Ah, black-eyed, gray gravy, absorbent of essences, eaten on New Year's Eve. Black-eyed peas. That's Roy Blunt's Song to Onions.
I have one little bit of onion news. I did read that India, which is a very large international onion producer, is now forbidding the exports of onions. Well, they must need them for their own population, but it said in the news article that this is going to cause a global onion shortage, which it sounds very sad to me from a culinary point of view.
That may just upset people, because we all need onions.
Having a bread shortage causes riots, but I'm sure having an onion shortage is going to make a lot of unhappiness.
Ha. I want to mention an upcoming thing here. We've run across an article, and we'll probably be looking into this more. It's called Cancer in Iowa. Agriculture play?
This has been hitting the headlines lately. Apparently, Iowa is now number two cancer rate.
Yeah.
With Kentucky being number one.
And so we're kind of looking into that now. And there's a lot of agricultural connections. And we often have bummer news. But here's some sort of good news. Iowa Extension is holding up free workshops for private well owners to find out what exactly is in their water, what exactly actual runoffs are happening. So contact your county extension office, because we just may have some questions as to what is in our well.
Get your well water tested.
Yeah, and there'll be, it says here, only about 10% of Iowans with private wells test them for contaminants.
Whoops.
I think we should. Oh, I should better do that. I have a private well. Yes, I do. So let's be careful out there. Yes. So join us for a future Donald on the Kitchen Show. We'll always have something to talk about. We talked to Jan Flora today about immigrants and the workforce and their importance to the Iowa food production industry.
And economy overall.
Economy, yes. You've been listening to the Donald on the Kitchen. We come to you live at noon. We're repeated at 7 p.m. on Tuesdays. And we have a podcast. And you can find out more information at www.khoifm.org. We have a Donald on the Kitchen webpage there. Support this fine radio station. There's lots happening on community radio. We had music by the Barn Owl Band today. You heard Unqua Road, Liza Jane, and Georgia Railroad. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Excellent Engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.